Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Not in America, Book One in a Jewish Family Saga, by Roberta Kagan, narrated by Kelly Tager. Preface. Imagine, if you will, that you have boarded a time capsule, and it has transported you to a time and place where life was simpler, where the neighborhood children chased fireflies until well after dark, and folks never locked their doors. It's the late 1920s, and violent crime is unheard of in this small fictitious town that lies stretched along the St. Lawrence Seaway in upstate New York. This quaint little village lies huddled under elms and weeping willow trees, far from the sins of the big city. Let us give this little town a name. Let us call her Medina. With her tree-lined streets, white wood farmhouses, and heavily scented rose bushes, was divided into two distinct and very different sectors. The larger of the two areas was populated by hard-working folks, most of whom were employed at the local factories. Now, although it wasn't discussed very much, it was true that some of these folks in that very sector belonged to a mean-spirited group known as the KKK. But the KKK kept to themselves, so no one paid much attention. On the other side of Medina was the smaller section. It was only a few streets away, but once you passed the corner of Main Street, where the synagogue stood, with two stained glass windows and a large wooden door, you knew you'd entered the Jewish part of town. On Friday nights and on Jewish holidays, one might hear the lovely baritone sound of the cantor coming from inside the temple. The people who made their homes here were primarily Jewish immigrants, who were business owners and professionals. Although there was always an awareness on both sides that an invisible line lay between them that must never be crossed, these two very different groups of people had lived side by side for centuries without much trouble. They even frequented each other's sectors and often spoke courteously to one another. Sometimes the non-Jewish housewives bought bread at the Jewish bakery or had their shoes fixed by the Jewish cobbler. The Jewish families sometimes ventured to the other side to visit a movie theater or a museum. And all was well. At least, until it wasn't. One day, something happened. Something that rocked the little village like an earthquake. Something that sent shockwaves through the Jewish people who had built their lives in that small, comfortable, protected town, making them realize that even in America, where the streets were surely paved in gold, they must never take their safety for granted. Even here, hatred for God's chosen people lay buried right beneath the oak tree in the village square. And in the time it takes for lightning to flash down from the sky, everything they'd spent their lives building could be consumed by flames. But this couldn't happen. Not in America. Could it? Prologue. 4-year-old Evelyn Wilson knew it was a bold move to enter the fort that her 8-year-old brother, Ted, and his friends built in the backyard of her family's home. Ted had made it clear that this was a boys-only clubhouse, and she was not welcome. So she walked slowly toward the fort. It was a structure made of wood and painted with white paint, with a sign outside that read, "Members Only." Gingerly, Evelyn peeked inside, expecting to hear Ted start hollering as soon as he saw her face. But the clubhouse was empty. She was a little surprised Ted and his friends weren't there. However, she knew her brother and his friends often played by the creek that lay just a few feet into the woods behind the family's home. So she headed there to find him.
"Mommy sent me to find Ted. She wants him to come home. He better not be mean to me or I am telling on him," she thought. "And if I can get him to come into the house, Mommy will be so happy with me that she'll probably give me a whole cookie instead of the half she promised." Evelyn loved the forest. In the summer, she loved all the different shades of green, the leaves on the trees, the grass, the weeds. But it was autumn now, and even more beautiful. She skipped and kicked her way through a blanket of brightly colored leaves that covered the forest floor. Crunch, crunch, crunch. The sound of the leaves beneath her feet, as she danced and twirled like a ballerina as she made her way to the little creek, had Evelyn singing softly to herself. The last of the summer wildflowers grew randomly. Smiling, she gathered a small bouquet. "I'll bring them for Mommy." Then the little girl spotted a cluster of dandelions that had grown like a pot of gold beneath a tree. Their heads, the color of sunshine, beckoned, and she couldn't resist the opportunity to make a dandelion necklace. Plopping down, Evelyn began to pick the yellow flowers, careful not to destroy their beauty. Next, she tore a slit just large enough for the stem of the next flower to fit through. Careful not to break the stem, she pulled it through slowly. To make a perfect dandelion necklace took complete focus, and Evelyn became so engrossed in the project that she momentarily forgot about her brother. Still singing softly to herself, she worked diligently on her project. "Hello." A voice interrupted her song. It was a teenage boy with wild, wavy hair and the soft brown stubble of a splotchy beard. It was the beginning of facial hair that indicated this was a boy who had not yet become a man. He smiled as he peeked out from behind a tree and winked at her with intense blue eyes. "What's your name?" Evelyn jumped. The boy had startled her. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you," he said in a sincere tone, his blue eyes twinkling.
"Evelyn is my name," she said a little leery.
He seemed nice. His eyes and smile were bright. But something about him frightened her, although she could not say exactly what it was.
"Evelyn," he repeated.
"That's a very pretty name. What are you doing here all alone in the forest?" he asked as he moved closer to her. She cowered a little and tried to get to her feet. A voice in her head told her to go home, but there were some wet leaves under her, and she slid back down until she was sitting under the tree. She tried to get up again, but the boy was now standing directly in front of her, so close that she couldn't move. Evelyn squinted up at him. The sun was blinding her, so she was unable to see his face clearly.
"I'm looking for my brother. I think he is playing here in the woods. I think I should go and try to find him," she said.
"Well, who is your brother? Because I know everyone in the woods," he said.
"Do you know him?" she asked, confused.
"I probably do," he smiled. "But the only way I can tell you if I know him is if you tell me his name."
"Ted."
"But of course I know Ted."
The boy smiled again. His tone of voice was warm and reassuring.
"Would you like me to take you to him?"
"Yes, I would like that very much. But you're a stranger, and my mommy said I should never go with strangers."
"She's absolutely right about that. You should never go with strangers,"
the boy said, his face and tone suddenly becoming serious. For a few seconds, he was silent, as if he were contemplating something. Then out of nowhere, he let out a friendly laugh.
"So how about this? I'll tell you who I am, and then we won't be strangers anymore."
Evelyn cocked her head to the side. It sounded logical.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"I am the forest elf. I am a friend to all children. I would bet that you have heard of me in fairy tales."
"Maybe. I don't remember any that mentioned you, though."
He laughed.
"It's all right. let me tell you a little about me. I am always the hero who saves little children from wicked witches, and who helps little girls to find their brothers. By the way, how old are you?
Evelyn held up 4 fingers.
4 years old? I thought you were at least 6.
You did. My big brother is 8.
Yes, I did think you were at least 6. You look very grown up. And you said your name is Evelyn, right? See, I remembered.
She nodded.
Good. You see, I know how old you are, and your name, too. And you know who I am, the forest elf, right?
Yes.
So now we are officially no longer strangers. Besides all of that, I am also an old friend of your brother's. His name is Ted, right?
My brother? You are saying that you know him, but I don't remember seeing you at our house or playing in the fort. Ever.
Well, I have been to your home, and I've played in the fort. But I can only come out of the forest once in a while, and I can't stay very long. That's because I have too much work to do in the forest. So we must have missed each other when I was at your house. But as you can see, there is no need to be afraid of me. Ted and I are old friends. And now you and I are old friends too, Evelyn. Give me your hand, and I'll help you get up, he said, smiling. Then I'll take you to your brother.
She felt a shiver run down her spine, but she ignored it and gave him her hand. The forest elf turned to Evelyn with a big smile on his face.
I know just where to find your brother, he said, as they began to walk deeper into the woods.
Evelyn could hear her own heartbeat as she opened her eyes in the dark space. But something was covering her eyes. She could not see. And even so, no light filtered in at all, only darkness. Desperately, she pulled at the ropes that bound her hands and feet. Then a sob escaped her lips. She tried to scream, but something was choking her. A scarf, perhaps? It had been placed tightly around her mouth, holding it open so she could not speak. Mommy, she thought, I want my mommy. Tears burned her eyes. The last thing she remembered was that forest elf. They'd been walking. The sun had been shining. She'd been singing. He had been singing with her. And then she had somehow ended up here, in this complete blackness, alone. Tied up and terrified. Footsteps came from somewhere, followed by whispers. She could not make out what was being said. All she knew was fear. Pure, unadulterated fear. Blinding, heart-stopping fear. Then the door to the small closet opened. A bright light flashed in front of her, assaulting her eyes. She winced in pain. But a few seconds later, her eyes adjusted. It was then that she saw them. If she could have made a sound, it would have been a scream, the desperate scream of a caged animal. They stood before her, 3 figures that looked like ghosts, with white sheets covering their bodies and black surrounding their eyes. They had enormous, doughy-looking noses. She trembled.
Please let me go. I want my mommy, she tried to say, but no words could escape her bound lips.
Do you know who we are?
A strange, deep, and terrifying voice said. She shook her head, and again she tried to speak.
Mommy, please, I want my mommy.
But again her words were lost.
We are the Jews. We've taken you because we plan to use your blood for our Jewish rituals. Remember who we are. We are Jews.
Then one of the ghosts removed the gag from her mouth.
Say it. Who are we?
I want my mommy. Please, I want my mommy. I want to go home.
Evelyn said.
Shut up.
She recognized the voice of the forest elf. Or say what you were told to say. Who are we?
Forest elf, is that you? I want to go home. Please rescue me. You said you rescue children.
I'm not the forest elf, you dumb child. We are the Jews. Now if you want to live, repeat it. Who are we?
The Jews, the Jews, the Jews. Please, can I go home? Evelyn cried, and her entire body shaking.
One of the ghosts replaced the gag, and then the closet door closed, burying the child in darkness once again.
I think it worked, one of the three costumed figures said to the other two.
Let's hope so.
Chapter 1. Medina, New York, September 1928, 6 p.m. The kitchen in the home where little Evelyn Wilson lived with her parents and her brother Ted. Marjorie Wilson let out a cry of pain when she nicked her finger while cutting an onion for the stew she was preparing for dinner. Grabbing a kitchen towel, she wrapped the cut to stop the bleeding. After a few minutes, she looked at the damage. It was only a surface cut, not too deep. It hurt, but at least she did not need medical attention. She knew she had cut herself because she was distracted, not paying attention to what she was doing. But she was very worried. It was getting late, and neither of her children were home. They knew better than to be out this late. They knew better. Carefully, she picked the knife up again and went back to working on the onions. If only I could calm down, she thought. She wanted to believe Evelyn and Ted were just off playing somewhere, and that they just lost track of time. But she was a mother, and a mother's instinct is strong. Something is not right. The likelihood of Ted playing with his 4-year-old sister is slim. He wouldn't stay out to play with her, and Evelyn is afraid of the dark. She has never stayed out like this before, never. Where are my children? Just then, she heard the wooden porch steps creak. Her head whipped around to face the direction of the sound. Her heart beat fast. Footsteps. They are home, thank God. Her hands were trembling so badly that she had to lay the knife down. The door opened. She felt her breath catch in her throat.
Hi, honey.
Herbert, her husband said, removing his hat. Then he turned to look at her.
What's wrong? You're as pale as a newly fallen snow in January.
The children aren't home. It's 6 o'clock, and the children aren't home.
He glanced at the bloody rag wrapped around her hand.
You cut yourself?
She nodded.
It's nothing. It's not deep.
You look frazzled. It's only 6 o'clock. Ted's been out later than this before. I know we've told him time and again to come in earlier, but he doesn't always listen. Nothing to worry yourself about.
What about Evelyn? She should be home. She would never do this.
Have you checked the fort?
Don't you think I've checked there 100 times already? They aren't back there.
Well, let me just go and check one more time, he said, trying to sound reassuring.
But Marjorie knew her husband, and she could see in his face that he was worried, too.
I'll just go and have a look. You wait right here, all right?
He said, patting her shoulder. She nodded as he walked out, the door flapping behind him. Marjorie put her head in her hands and waited for Herb to return. The onion juice that stained her fingers was making her eyes water. Between the smell from the onion, the blood-soaked cloth, the nagging fear and uncertainty, she felt sick to her stomach. The porch steps creaked again. It is too soon for Herbert to have returned. It must be the children. Her heart jumped into her throat and began to beat so rapidly that she gagged. The door squeaked open. She held her breath. It has to be the children, she thought. Please, God, let it be my children.
Ted!
She screamed as he entered the house.
Sorry I am so late, Mom,
Ted said, pulling off his jacket and then his cap and hanging them on the coat rack in the living room. Marjorie jumped to her feet.
She slapped him across the face. Then she grabbed him and hugged him to her tightly and began to cry.
"Where is your sister? Is she with you?"
she asked hopefully. Ted looked at his mother, puzzled. Her body was trembling, her eyes wild.
"I haven't seen her since breakfast this morning," he said. "Oh, my God!"
Marjorie put her hand on her chest and dropped back into her chair.
"Oh, my God!"
The door opened, and once again, for a single second, Marjorie stared at the door with her mouth hanging open, her body trembling. A drop of blood seeped through the towel and dripped onto the kitchen table.
"Evelyn, please, God, let it be Evelyn."
She felt as if she were suspended over the earth, walking on a tightrope. Beads of sweat formed on her brow. But it wasn't Evelyn. Herb, her husband, walked in.
"They aren't in the fort."
He threw his hands up. Then he saw Ted.
"There you are, son. Where is your sister?"
"I don't know." Ted shrugged his shoulders. "Like I told Mom, I haven't seen her since this morning."
"Where have you been?"
his father asked angrily.
"You know better than to come home this late. I ought to take the strap to you."
"I was fishing at the creek with Billy and Fred. I am sorry. I didn't mean it. I lost track of time. Please don't hit me."
"Are you sure you haven't seen your sister? It's important that you try to remember." "It's very important," Herb said.
"I haven't seen her, but I promise I won't be late again. Just please don't take the strap to me. Please, Dad, I didn't mean it."
Herb didn't answer his son. He turned and looked at his wife.
"I'm going to go from house to house. I'll talk to all the people in the neighborhood and see what I can find out. Maybe she is visiting with one of the other children, or maybe someone has seen her. Meanwhile, you go to town and tell the sheriff that she is missing."
"Oh, my God. Do you think something happened to her? Oh, Herb, we must find her before nightfall."
"I'm sure everything is fine. She is probably at one of the neighbors' houses."
Herbert Wilson tried to sound calm.
"But I agree with you. It's best that we find her before dark. So let's get moving,"
he said and took his hat off the coat rack. Then he turned to his son.
"You come with me," he said.
Chapter 2.
Marjorie walked as quickly as she could toward the police station. Her heart was beating fast, and her thoughts were racing. The darkened streets and the sound of her own heels clicking on the sidewalk unnerved her. Her mind's eye was like the screen of a horror film. Over and over, she replayed the last few moments she'd spent with her daughter. And over, she chastised herself.
"Where is my Evelyn? What has become of her?"
Marjorie Wilson thought, and the movie began again.
Chapter 3. Marjorie Wilson remembers what she was doing just moments before her daughter disappeared. The golden days of Indian summer had slowly descended upon the small town of Medina, which lay along the St. Lawrence Seaway in upstate New York. Marjorie Wilson glanced up at the round, black-rimmed clock on her kitchen wall. It was almost 4:30 in the afternoon, and her 8-year-old son, Ted, had still not come home from school. Sunlight spilled through the kitchen window. It fell upon a plate of cookies that Marjorie had arranged in the middle of the table for the children to snack on. She grunted and shook her head. It was too late for the children to snack on cookies now. If they ate them, they would ruin their dinner. She thought of Ted's lack of responsibility with disgust. He'd promised her that he would come home right after school and do his homework before he went out to play. But she could never count on him to keep his word, and this was not the first time he'd run off with his friends and then had to stay up late to finish his schoolwork. Over the past summer, Marjorie's husband, Herbert, had helped Ted and Ted's friends to build a fort in the backyard, and she assumed that when the boys arrived at the house after school, they'd see the fort and be immediately drawn to it. And so they'd go out to play instead of doing their homework. She took a deep breath.
She had to finish peeling the pile of potatoes in front of her. She needed them for tonight's dinner. And Herb would be home soon. So, rather than stopping her work to go out to the backyard herself to find her son, she called for her 4-year-old daughter, who was busy playing with her doll in her room.
"Evelyn!" she yelled. "Evie, come on into the kitchen. I need you to do something for me, sweetheart."
A bright little girl with shining eyes and a messy page boy haircut came skipping into the kitchen.
"Can I have a cookie, Mommy?"
she said, as her eyes landed on the plate of cookies on the table.
"No, it's getting too close to dinner. I'm afraid if you do, you won't want to eat your food. But you can have one for dessert."
Evelyn pouted.
"But we always have a snack. Is it because Ted is late getting home?"
"Yes, I'm afraid it is," Marjorie said. "But don't worry, there will be cookies for dessert." She smiled.
"I hate Ted. If he had come home, we could have had cookies."
"I promise you, you can have 2 cookies for dessert. How does that sound?"
"Good,"
Evelyn smiled.
"Now, I need you to go out to the backyard to the fort and get your brother. Tell him that Mom is very upset with him. You tell him I said that I want him in this house right now. He knows that he is to do his homework before going out to play."
"Do I have to go, Mommy? I want to play with my dolly."
"Yes, you have to go."
Marjorie looked at her daughter's sweet face, and it broke her resolve.
"All right, I'll tell you what. If you go out back and get your brother for me, I'll give you 1/2 of a cookie when you both come in."
"All right, Mommy, I'll go."
Why did I send her? She is only 4. What was I thinking? Dear God, please forgive me and bring my child home.
As Evelyn began to walk toward the screen door, she turned to her mother and said,
"You know, Ted gets mad every time I go inside the fort. He yells at me and tells me to get out. He says it's not a place for a girl. He says it's a boys-only clubhouse."
"Well, that's too bad for him. You tell him that I said he needs to come into the house right this minute," Marjorie said.
"Yes, Mommy."
"All right, now hurry back. I want you to come right back in and wash up for dinner before your father gets home. And if Ted can get his homework done, maybe we can have an early dinner. Then we can all sit outside on the porch tonight, and you 2 can collect fireflies. You would like that, wouldn't you?"
"Yes, Mother,"
Evelyn said, as she skipped out the door. The screen door bounced on its hinges.
I can still hear the sound of the door hitting the wood. Why did I let her go? Why?
Marjorie clenched her fists until her nails dug into her palms. She wanted to hurt herself. She deserved to feel the pain. This was her fault.
If something bad has happened to Evie, it is because of me.
Chapter 4, 6 p.m., the home of Roger, Mary, and Frank Weston.
Roger Weston was fuming. The streetcar had been very late, and he was in a hurry to get home from his job at the aluminum plant, because tonight was the weekly meeting of the KKK, and he said he would attend. This meeting would be no different from all the others, but because it was an election year, and the Klan wanted to make sure their followers were on board with their support of Hoover, a man they felt represented them, they encouraged attendance at the weekly meetings. It was important, Roger knew, that Hoover beat Smith. Smith was a man who was loved by the immigrants, particularly the Catholics. If Smith won, it was certain things would change for the true Americans like himself. There would be more attention paid to the needs of the Italian and Irish immigrants, and he'd come to truly hate the ones he worked with at the plant. They were Catholics, and Roger, like his fellow Klan members, hated Catholics almost as much as they hated the Jews. And he had to say, they truly despised and feared the small Jewish community in Medina. The men with their long beards and their strange curled sideburns, the women with their covered heads. Whenever he was forced to walk past their little Jew temple, he spit on the ground. In order to reinforce their shared hatred of the Jews, The KKK meetings always concluded with one of the members reading aloud from Henry Ford's book, The International Jew. Roger.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?